We've been sitting down with Steve Marchand, and for a few more minutes, we're going to answer those questions we didn't get to during our regular hour and to take more questions from our Facebook Live audience. So if you're just joining us, Steve Marchand is, so far, the only Democrat announced running for New Hampshire governor against incumbent Republican Chris Sununu. And Steve, thanks for sticking around for a few more minutes for our Facebook Live audience. And our Facebook Live viewers have already been sending in lots of questions.
Great.
Here's one from Sean. Wages in New Hampshire are largely divorced from the costs of living, especially for young people in entry and lower level jobs. Given the lack of youth representation in the legislature, how will you fight to keep young people in the economy? Sean, thank you for the question.
Well, he identifies first a process problem we have. Because of our volunteer legislature making $100 a year and so forth, you got a lot of wonderful people on both sides of the aisle willing to basically volunteer their time. But it also means huge swaths of the electorate, of the population, would have a really tough time getting engaged. And this includes younger people. So I think that's, we see that in the policy. I think he's right about that. Look, the number one thing businesses told me is it's talent. They didn't ask for a cut in the business profits tax. They didn't ask for no minimum wage. They didn't ask for right to work. What they asked for was get me more talent. And so there are a number of ways we get it. And I alluded to it near the end of the radio broadcast. The number one way to attract young people, thank you, and keep them is actually pre-K through 12 public education. People in their 20s that are trying to figure out where do they want to set up their life. So they may not have kids yet, but they're thinking about it. You got to connect that with commuter rail. And I think a lot of times we talk about commuter rail in southern New Hampshire, but we don't connect it to local quality education as a 1-2 punch. The education is what often attracts or retains young people aspiring to build a life together. But then connecting it to one of the two or three best economies in the country, the 128 belt, Boston, that's not a problem. Chris Sununu often criticizes Massachusetts because that's what we do in New Hampshire, except for it's been one of our assets, our proximity to this amazing economy, the healthcare system they have, the higher education. This is a good thing, and we should take a straw that is commuter rail and plop that thing right into the juicy orange that is the greater Boston economy.
I've never thought about commuter rail as a straw. So people would love commuter rail if it were free, but the cost that always comes up, and anywhere of $250 million to $300 million to build this thing. So where does that money come from?
Well, a few things. First of all, I do think this is a place where in the long run, there's some federal resources that may be available that can help bring that sticker price down, certainly on the front end, the construction of it.
Even with the Trump administration, which has not been friendly to rail.
Well, keep in mind, the earliest I'm getting in is 2019, and this is going to take a while before shovels hit the ground. So part of this is we'll see if Donald Trump gets a second term or not. Right now, I think the folks feel like they're electing Chris Sununu again will be the equivalent of reaffirming or unaffirming how Trump did in 2016. But beyond that, look, there's a lot of other forms of infrastructure that we don't call subsidy, but they clearly have a public funding element to it. When you drive up and down I-93, that's not free. That is paid for. By the public sector. And there's not even a toll on that section of 93. When you look at clean water, when you look at reliable wastewater and water functions, when you go up sidewalks, everything we think of, there is a public funding element to it.
Sure.
And we have to have that conversation as it relates to rail as well.
Paid by gas taxes or property taxes or whatever it
may
be.
Or general fund in a lot. Like if you think about local government services, most local government services, be they police, fire, sanding and salting of roads, education, they're paid for not with a user fee, right? Only 1 out of 5 households in New Hampshire have a school-age kid. But we don't tell the other 80% that you don't pay for education.
So Nashua wants this. Manchester wants this. Concord has been looking at it. But north of Concord, why should people chip into commuter rail if they never take it?
Well, for the same reason that people in southern New Hampshire should chip in other ways that we help out the northern part of the state's economy. As I said in the radio broadcast, I've got a lot of family, a lot of roots up, way up. Some people think, like Franklin is northern New Hampshire. Give me a break. Come to Pittsburgh, where it's 45 minutes from the time you enter the town to the time you get to my aunt's farm, also in Pittsburgh. That's Cowas County. And when I look at places like Colebrook and Lancaster and Whitefield and Berlin and Gorham and Groveton, they have wonderful skeletons of downtowns that places like Windham would kill to have, but they cannot build. And if we put the right infrastructure at the state level that allows them to attract entrepreneurs, over a 10-year period, you can create dynamism in those economies that is not simply tourism, but that takes some state support disproportionately. Most people live in the southern part of the state. So we all, look, if we are the least efficient state in America, Laura, we are the least efficient state in America. No state in America has less of a fiscal relationship between state government and local government than the state of New Hampshire, and it means we use scale less than any state in America. I audit cities, counties, and states for a living. My friends who've done it for 40 years tell me when they want to see what 19th century governance in America looked like, they come to New Hampshire today when the U.S. News and World Report study comes out, you know, and they say we're number 5 or number 3, went down to 5 this year. We do great in all the categories except for one, governance. We're below average nationally in one category. It's the only reason we're not U.S. News' best state in America every year.
Well, on the other hand, one could argue low unemployment, low crime, decent schools, often voted, as you said, on those lists among the top 10, you know, high rates of income, you know, among the top 10 per capita income. So maybe this system you see is inefficient and antiquated isn't doing so badly.
Number one, we're heading in the wrong direction in a lot of metrics. Remember, one of four states that lost net jobs in 2017. We do not have our hands around the opiate crisis. Second highest median age, lowest birth rate. No state lost a higher percentage of its high school population in the last 10 years than the state of New Hampshire. We lost a quarter of our K-12 population in just 15 years, and it is freaking out the private sector because they have no idea who they'll hire if they invest in New Hampshire. We are the frog in slowly boiling water. It feels okay right now. We are buoyed by the greater Boston's very strong economy. That helps us indirectly. But if we do not get proactive, look at the best practices, get somebody as a leader, as governor, who actually is the guy you didn't want to see because I'm the auditor that comes in. That's who you want as a governor because I can identify the way we talk about it, the vision to know what to do, the competence to know how to do it, the courage to say it out loud.
Well, Sean, thank you for that question. Again, we're taking some questions that we didn't get to in our regular hour and some questions from our Facebook Live viewers. This is a special overtime edition of The Exchange with Steve Marchand. So, Sean, thank you for that one. Timothy also sent us a question on Facebook Live. You've already addressed it. Steve, I think. But how does Mr. Marchand hope to keep and or get a young workforce in New Hampshire? This is something New Hampshire has had trouble with. Signed, a millennial in New Hampshire's workforce. So, Timothy, thank you for that. And here's another one on a similar vein that came in during the regular hour that we didn't get to. This is Jacob in Manchester. As a student at UNH Manchester with friends that go to both UNH Manchester and UNH Durham, what would you do to reduce the cost to attend college in-state? Jacob says $15,000 per year to attend the flagship university is a lot of money, especially when you factor in additional fees depending on college room and board. And I've been looking at this myself because I have an 18-year-old, and it's full freight at UNH Durham, $30,000. Wow.
Yes.
In-state.
Yes. Oh, in-state. First, we often compare New Hampshire to last year's New Hampshire and next year's New Hampshire. But the work I do makes me look around the country. The most conservative lawmaker in Wyoming or Mississippi votes for higher levels of state support for higher education than the most liberal members in New Hampshire. It is hard to overstate how much of an outlier we are nationally in this regard. We have to look at higher ed, and by the way, that's community college, that's traditional four-year, and the way we even look at trade schools because of the tremendous need in a lot of the building trades. My dad's a carpenter. It brought us into the middle class with an eighth-grade education. It is the real thing with good money to be made there, too, and it's not dirty work. It's tremendous work. We should say that. In all of these places, the combination, you know, when I went to college in 92, I got into UNH, and they said, good news, you're in. $13,000. Now, today that sounds wonderful, but in 92, you know. And my problem is a family that had recently filed bankruptcy, even though I was a straight-A kid and a straight-arrow guy. My problem was $12,000 ago. So, like, freezing tuition or slowing down, that doesn't help the first-generation college student. So I'm not just trying to find ways to slowly increase state aid to higher ed. That helps on the margins. I have a pilot program on my website, stevemarchand.com, that can deal with simultaneously keeping young people in state, dealing with student debt, as this question gets at, and attacks the mismatch between talent and needs in the economy by providing a matching program that can provide debt-free in-state tuition at our public universities for those that go into a five-year co-op-style program
Like they have at Northeastern.
Which is one of the best in the country, and it gets people ready for work. We often think about the employee, like the how hard it is to get through college. The employer's taking a lot of risk when they make a hire. And when they get a chance at a co-op model to kick the tires on somebody, they can figure it out for themselves, and the person they would hire is getting real job skills, often paid at some pretty decent money, that helps them in the interim to be able to minimize the bills they may be incurring. When we look at best practices, we can actually get to debt-free college in selected places in a pilot program I have.
Well, Jacob, thank you for the email. And I feel like I keep asking you this question, Steve, but okay, so more money for higher education. Where does that money come from? I mean, again, we're a low-tax state. I'm assuming you don't support a broad-based sales or income tax, but maybe I'm wrong there.
No, that's correct.
Okay.
However, a few things. On the infrastructure, which we talked about, a gas tax increase kind of, and that snugs into that pretty directly. We should reverse the recent rounds of the business profits tax cut. The businesses I talked to did not ask for that. But you know what they did ask for? America's best pre-K through 12 public education. They asked for a connection with higher ed. They asked for infrastructure improvements. They asked for real means of attacking the opiate challenge and addiction challenge that we have. So we can pay for a large amount of that by repealing the tax cut that they did not ask for.
Well, it's $100 million a year. I did want to ask you about that. Pretty early on, the legislature signed into law a series of tax cuts that come, one at a time, sort of over a period of time. And then I think there's two more slated to go into effect. You would stop those.
We should stop those and reverse the last ones. Now, I want to be clear.
That's not going to sound good. People are going to say, it's Steve Marchand. He's raising your taxes.
Don't believe me. Believe the businesses I talk to. Because when we say, oh, it's too bad we don't have the money to do mental health the right way, and we have an ombudsman basically saying we're not really getting it done. When we talk about DCYF and we go, well, it's too bad we got rid of the voluntary program. When we look at the Sununu Center and we say, oh, we're $3.6 million short, I guess we'll have to use the underfunded alcohol fund, redefine its uses, and then pay for it that way. That's the New Hampshire way. We stop the school building aid program. We steal from L-CHIP. We stop with the tobacco settlement fund to use it for general fund purposes when that was not its intention. We got rid of the wastewater treatment plan. We do this all the time, and we end up pushing down responsibilities without the check attached to the local level. And the number one tax in terms of state and local that most New Hampshireites pay, most entrepreneurs and new businesses pay, is the one that they are increasing with these policies, your local property tax.
If you rolled back those business tax increases, all of them, how much money is that? I mean, you had a long list of priorities
there.
About
$100 million a year.
Here's another question about education from Nathan on Facebook Live. Thank you, Nathan. He says, what about technical education, welding, plumbing, auto mechanics, etc.? Would Mr. Marchand work to bring more of that back into school? Now, this is a great question that we've heard from other people, that there used to be a lot more of what used to be called vo-tech programs in high schools. Anybody could take them. Those have been reduced, and sometimes those avenues are cut off.
Culturally, and I alluded to this a moment ago, so my mom doesn't have a high school degree. My dad didn't go to high school. French was the first language of our home. Everybody's from small communities near Sherbrooke, Quebec, and they came down, as is, I think, legally required on the west side of Manchester from Quebec in the 60s. But with that limited formal education, my dad is a carpenter since he's 14. He's 72. He's still working. The work ethic's unbelievable of our immigrant population, by the way. They are an entrepreneur machine. But the trades, there is such demand. But I think what we've done culturally over a few generations in our education system is we have implied that if you go to a high-end four-year on-campus experience, you are a success. And if you do not, you're somehow less successful. Like a two-year student at a technical school or community college, there's this implication over several decades that you're not quite as successful. And then if you don't go to there and you go into the trade, somehow it's dirty work. I'll tell you what the dirty work does. Call a plumber. Call an electrician. I did sheetrock with my dad, and I did carpentry with my dad. It's really hard work. And because of the supply and demand curves that we have in the state and country, you're making really good money for necessary work that cannot be outsourced.
So what's your answer to Nathan's question? Would you tell schools they need to do more of this? Would you give them more money to do it? Would you open up more pathways?
So at the earliest ages, I'm talking our guidance counselor system, and I've talked to guidance counselors in this. You're seeing some best practices around the state in this regard. At an earlier age, we need to introduce not just here's where you can get a local scholarship to help you go to college. That's fine. That's great. And it needs to be more about here's where the economy is. Here's where the needs are. Where are your passions? Where are your skills? And let's begin at even earlier ages, making that match between skill, passion, and need in the economy. And what we find in a lot of places is that if we don't discourage, but instead we encourage a lot of the building trades as a place where you can get a great career in state, making really good money, high five figures, six figures in some cases. We need to introduce that to young people and their families at far earlier ages than we do right now.
Well, Nathan, thank you for the question. Couple more questions from our Facebook Live viewers. And I want to thank everybody for participating. I've got more questions here than we have time for, so that's great. Here's one from Zach. Would you push for an offshore wind farm?
Oh, I do support offshore wind.
And how far offshore? Because some people don't want to see that from from Hampton Beach or wherever.
I'll be honest, I would need to understand the science better because I don't want to give you a number from somebody that's not my background.
Sure.
So this is, you're an expert in a couple of things when you run for governor. In everything else, you're in the constant state of learning, evaluating, deciding, and then leading. So on this, I certainly support the concept. I've talked to folks who've given me enough comfort that I could say it, as I just did to you. But in terms of the specifics, that's where I need to talk to those experts more to make sure we don't do something that would be ineffective or that might have some negative environmental impact or something like that.
But at this point, offshore wind sounds okay to you.
I generally favor it.
Because I'm sure you're aware they tried to do this off Cape Cod or in Massachusetts, and it took a long, long, long time. People said, I don't want to see those towers out there. I want to see my beautiful ocean view.
Right. But in large parts of the country where, obviously on coasts, they have found ways to strike this balance, and I'm optimistic we could as well.
All right, Zach, thank you for that one. Here's one from Colin. When was the last mass shooting in New Hampshire? I can't recall of any at all. New Hampshire is consistently ranked one of the safest states in the country. Why, Colin asks, are you pushing gun control laws to fix a problem that we don't have? Colin, thank you.
Well, note, I don't call it gun control because that implies I'm trying to take your guns. It's reducing gun violence. And I'm very straight up at the beginning of the radio program. We talked about it. Over 90% of gun deaths in New Hampshire are suicide. And so while the attention tends to be drawn to the most dramatic and widespread mass shooting, domestic violence, and homicide, the reality is that in New Hampshire, and to a lesser extent in the country, if we don't have a serious, specific conversation about reducing gun-related suicide, we're not really going to get at where the greatest amount of gun deaths occur. And I would bet, as I found out last week in Lebanon with some very passionate Second Amendment, zealots, this is a place where we did find agreement. And so a 48-hour wait period, that's not gun control. If I know that we can save dozens of lives a year in New Hampshire, and if done nationally, thousands of lives a year, simply with a 48-hour wait period, like many states have done, I will take that choice 8 days a week. And in the other areas, they largely simply say, how do we reduce the risk of mass shootings and other forms of gun violence?
Well, and Colin, I remember a mass shooting in New Hampshire back in 1997. In Colebrook, four people were killed, yep. A newspaper man, a judge, and two police officers, two state troopers. So, by Colebrook standards, that's a mass shooting for
people. Well, and it doesn't happen very often, obviously. And as I said, in New Hampshire, there were only about 10 deaths last year that were not suicide at the barrel of a gun. So this is less about trying to stop something that is happening outside of suicide in a rampant fashion. It's about recognizing the best practices of other states and mitigating risk of it happening in the future.
I want to close out with a political question for you. And here's an email that came in earlier from Jerry in Dover, who says, unfortunately, the voters of this state vote for names they know, which, Jerry says, is how Sununu was elected. He says, unless a Democratic candidate has a recognizable name, they will not be elected. Here's my question. In the first district where you've lived most of your life, you've raised your family, you were born there, you live there, you work there, how do you feel about the announcement of Levy Sanders, who lives in the second district, coming to run in the first district where he doesn't live and never has?
Well, I know Levy reasonably well, and he's going to have to answer some questions that have arisen that you're alluding to. People are going to run in the first CD. But I know this, that within the context of this very diverse and still growing first CD field, It is absolutely helping me as a candidate because of the additional interest it's generating from all pockets of the potential Democratic base. And whether it's Sanders or one of the other candidates, it's a very deep and rich field of candidates that I think is going to draw people out. And I think that's obviously beneficial for me as a gubernatorial candidate.
Well, Steve Marchand, you've been very generous giving us a little extra time in this special Facebook Live overtime segment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura.
Steve Marchand, again, so far, he's the only Democrat running for governor here in New Hampshire. And thanks to all of you who joined us, who contributed questions for this special post-show edition of The Exchange on Facebook Live. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is NHPR.